Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Well, it's Friday. It's February 28th, no less, and it's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. It'll be just you and I today, very intimate setting. And I want to just wish you a good day, and we'll get started with so much that's going on the world stage. We'll start off with what's happening in our hemisphere. Well, it seems that their protests have hit Chile as the nation ponders whether they should rewrite Pinochet's constitution. Campaigning for next month's referendum on changing Chile's dictatorship-era constitution began on Wednesday, more than 4 months after an outbreak of unrest that triggered the ballot. And more than 14 million Chileans will be eligible to vote on April 26 on changing a charter established in 1980 under the military rule of Augusto Pinochet, who was at the helm from 1973 to 1990. It has been changed before by referendum, following a 1988 vote that paved the way for a return to democracy. So many tears and so much blood have been spilled so that we could have a different constitution, Camilo Sanchez, the president of the Young Communists, told Agence France-Presse. Now, demonstrations that have left more than 30 people dead first broke out on October 18 of last year, initially against a modest metro fare hike, you know, the local train and bus rides in the capital of Santiago. But it quickly mushroomed into a wider anger at social injustice. And one of the demonstrators' main demands, alongside cheaper education and health care, has been a change to the Constitution. A month later, right-wing Piñera and his government coalition agreed to hold the historic referendum. Quote, the government is committed to encouraging Chileans to participate and to ensure a fair, democratic, and transparent vote, Piñera said on Monday, this past Monday, following clashes between protesters and security forces at the weekend in the seaside resort of Viña del Mar. Campaigning will end 3 days before the referendum. Voters opting to change the Constitution will be asked if the redrafting should be carried out by people specifically elected for the job, perhaps via the formation of a new constituent assembly. Now, the government favors a committee, half of which would be made up of existing lawmakers, while directly elected members would form the other half. Chileans would vote for the group in October, and members would then have 9 months to come up with a new constitution, a period that could be extended 3 months. According to the last election poll, or by Activa research, 69% of Chileans were in favor of a change, with only 14.5% against it. So we'll have to see where all that goes. Then, let's go over here, again, part of the hemisphere. Five people were killed in a shooting at a brewery in Wisconsin. Absolutely unbelievable. A gunman opened fire at the Molson Coors Beverage Company brewing complex in Milwaukee on Wednesday, killing five employees before he was found dead from an apparently self-inflicted gunshot, the city's police chief had said. Now, no other people were injured in the violence, which erupted about 2 p.m. local time at the sprawling campus of more than 20 buildings where more than 1,000 workers are employed by the beer company in Wisconsin's largest city, the chief had said. Time, and we will continue to investigate throughout the night, the chief had said, Alfonso Morales told reporters at a news conference hours after the shooting. Morales said that the bloodshed was confined to the Molson Coors facility and that, quote, no members of the general public were involved, end quote. The suspect was described only as a 51-year-old Milwaukee man. Details about the circumstances of the shooting, including what may have precipitated the carnage, were not provided by authorities. And President Donald Trump acknowledging the shooting as he opened a White House news conference about the coronavirus outbreak, referred to the gunman as a wicked murderer, and called the gun violence a, quote, a terrible thing, end quote. So, my God, see so much as far as violence is concerned. Well, and then referring to President Trump, Trump says that the coronavirus virus's risk to Americans is very low. And he names Vice President Pence to head the United States response. President Donald Trump assured Americans on Wednesday the risk for coronavirus remained very low, quote-unquote, and placed Vice President Mike Pence in charge of the U.S. response to the looming global health crisis. At a White House briefing with his coronavirus task force, Trump said public health officials were preparing to do, quote, whatever we have to, end quote, to deal with the outbreak. He said he would accept whatever amount of emergency spending Congress decided to allocate and was not immediately considering travel restrictions to and from countries such as South Korea and Italy that are dealing with outbreaks. The risk to the American people remains very low, Trump had said, flanked by Pence and public health officials. Quote, we're ready to adapt and we're ready to do whatever we have to as the disease spreads, if it spreads, he said, adding the spread of the virus in the United States was not inevitable, quote unquote. And continuing, he says, it probably will, if possibly will, it could be a very, very small level or it could be at a larger level. Whatever happens, we're totally prepared, he said. Public health officials on Wednesday warned Americans to prepare for more coronavirus cases, and New York City announced plans to provide up to 1,200 hospital beds if needed as U.S. stock markets fell for the fifth consecutive day. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said that while the virus was contained in the United States, Americans must prepare for a potential outbreak as transmission spread outside of China. Quote, if we have a pandemic, then almost certainly we are going to get impacted, Fauci told CNN. Officials at the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, on Tuesday said the virus global march had raised concern about its spread in the United States. And though it remained unclear when that might happen and how severe it would be, U.S. Health and Human Rights Secretary Alex Azar said that the United States has 59 coronavirus cases, including 42 American passengers repatriated from the Diamond Princess cruise ship docked in Japan. We have to be alert to the possibility of a pandemic, Peter Marks, the director of the Food and Drug Administration Center for Biologic Evaluation and Research, said in an interview. And New York Mayor Bill de Blasio called on the federal government to help it obtain 300,000 extra protective masks. There were no confirmed cases of coronavirus in the city, he said. Globalists in recent days due to worries over a prolonged disruption to supply chains and economies from the virus, which has infected about 80,000 people and killed nearly 3,000, mostly in China. U.S. stocks turned lower in afternoon trading on Wednesday, same on Thursday, and same today in a fresh wave of selling sparked by fears of the coronavirus spreading in the United States. And so that is the crisis that besets the world at the moment. Then just let's look at something else that might be interesting here in our hemisphere. Rio Carnival takes aim at Brazil's gun-toting, quote, messiah Bolsonaro. It seems that top samba schools in Brazil's Carnival, capital of Rio de Janeiro, paraded for a second night on Monday, peppering the annual sizzling fusion of music, dance, and costume with jabs at the country's president, Jair Bolsonaro. The last six of the city's 13 top samba schools took to the Sambódromo, or Samba Drome, with hundreds of colorfully dressed and some scantily clad dancers and magicians parading behind huge elaborate floats designed around a broad theme. Monday's parades, which ran well into the early hours of Tuesday, touched on many themes, among them Bolsonaro, who has cut a controversial and divisive, or he has cut a controversial and divisive figure since being sworn into office in January of last year. Brazilian actor and comedian Marcelo Adnet starred in the São Clemente School's parade, dressed up as Bolsonaro, mockingly doing push-ups, saluting, and firing an imaginary gun with his fingers, all of which the ex-army captain has done in public during his presidency. The São Clemente float also displayed placards with the words, K? Question mark with an exclamation mark, a popular Bolsonaro phrase, and quote, it was Leonardo DiCaprio, end quote, a reference to Bolsonaro blaming the Hollywood movie actor for the Amazon rainforest fires last year. Well, since Bolsonaro took office in January 2019, Brazilians have been sharply divided, with supporters crediting him for a rapid drop in violent crime and an improving economy, while critics have denounced his racism, sexism, and stance on the environment. On Sunday, the famed Mangueira Samba School took aim at the national rise in right-wing religious fervor and surge in police violence in Rio, in particular, in Bolsonaro's first 14 months. Well, Mangueira's song included a line about no messiah with a gun in his hand, a reference to Bolsonaro, whose middle name is Messias, and who advocates more widespread gun ownership. The costume, floats, and choreography of Rio Samba School may change, but they are always sparkling and spectacular, often taking all year and over $2 million to put together. Each year, the top 13 samba schools parade through the Samba Drome in front of up to 90,000 locals, tourists, and VIPs partying in the steep concrete stands and hospitality suites that line the 700-meter or 2,300-foot avenue. Now, the judges' verdicts are announced on national television on Ash Wednesday, a couple of days ago, and the 90,000-capacity Samba Drome was designed by revered architect Oscar Niemeyer and constructed in 1984. So, just a very, very compelling story, to say the least. Now, let's look at some other things around the world, and evidently, there's a deal. Seems that Volkswagen has struck a Dieselgate compensation deal with German consumers. An important chapter in Volkswagen's years-long Dieselgate emissions cheating saga appeared headed for a close today, as the German car giant agreed to a compensation deal with domestic consumer groups. Volkswagen and German Consumer Federation, VZBV, reached a comprehensive agreement in a first-of-its-kind collective lawsuit brought by around 400,000 diesel car drivers. The Brunswick State Court had said, or Brunswick. Anyway, the mass lawsuit is one of the biggest legal hangovers from Volkswagen's 2015 admission to fitting 11 million vehicles worldwide with software to make the engines appear less polluting in regulatory tests than in real driving conditions. Well, Consumer Federation VZBV said it would reveal details of the agreement at a 1 p.m. local time afternoon press conference. Under German law, plaintiffs have a month to decide whether to accept the settlement offer after its approval by judges. If fewer than 30% of them reject the deal, it will go ahead. Friday's announcement follows just 2 weeks after the two sides fell out in public after agreeing in principle on 830 million euros, that's $916.3 million, in payouts to four German diesel car drivers. Volkswagen said the talks failed because of disproportionate, end quote, fee demands from VZBV's lawyers. But the consumer group said the money was needed to set up, quote, a transparent, trustworthy, and secure system, end quote, to actually cash. Aside from the 400,000 diesel owners of the VZBV's grouped proceeding, around 70,000 individuals have opened claims against Volkswagen. In May, one individual's case will be heard at Germany's top administrative court, a ruling which could have influenced the outcome of the settlement talks. Well, so far the ballot, the fallout from Vin Diesel cheating has cost Volkswagen more than 30 billion euros worldwide in legal costs, fines, and compensation, most of it in the United States. While American diesel buyers enjoy generous buyback and compensation schemes, German drivers have so far gone uncompensated for the impact of the scandal, which has since spread to other car makers. In an online announcement after talks broke down early this month, Volkswagen said it was ready to pay out between 1350 and 6257 euros per vehicle, depending on model and age. Its conditions were that cars had to have been purchased before January 1 of 2016 with a buyer, a German resident, and still in possession of the car. Beyond compensation, Volkswagen appears to have got off comparatively light in fines levied in Germany. The Wolfsburg-based group and subsidiaries Audi and Porsche paid a total of 2.3 billion euros in fines in the group's home country. Beyond the actual owners of Volkswagen manipulated cars, manipulated in Dieselgate, investors are also pursuing Volkswagen for billions, hoping to recoup the financial harm they suffered when the group's shares plunged after the scandal broke. While the group has long since returned to profitability, it is making massive investments in electric mobility and automated driving in an attempt to catch up to a head start enjoyed by foreign competitors like Tesla. In the coming years, Volkswagen, its subsidiaries, and other German carmakers plan a slew of electric vehicles looking to polish their green credentials and avoid falling foul of harsh European Union fines for excessive greenhouse emissions. So, very compelling story and very interesting for them. Now, let's look at what happened. Evidently, there is a teen by the name of Naomi Zeibt, she's German, has become the darling of climate change deniers. Well, at 19, Naomi Zeibt is on her way to become a voice of climate skeptics. Close to the far right in her home country of Germany, she has also been propelled by the Heartland Institute, an American think tank supported by allies of U.S. President Donald Trump. Climate skeptics have found their muse, Naomi Zeibt, a German woman who denounces, quote, climate alarmism, end quote, in videos she posts on her YouTube channel. In December, the Heartland Institute, an American think tank engaged against scientific consensus on climate change, gave Zeibt top billing during its one-day forum on climate reality, quote unquote, which took place on the margins of the COP25, the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Madrid, in Spain. Now, 1 month later, the Institute featured Zeibt in a video posted on its own YouTube channel entitled Naomi Zeibt versus Greta Thunberg, Whom Should We Trust? End quote. And Greta Thunberg, quote, Greta Thunberg took the world by storm with her doomsday climate predictions, reads the video's description. Naomi Zeibt, a rising star, advocates for proper scientific discourse over climate change. Who seems like the more reasonable advocate to you? Question mark. Well, the media has cast Zeibt as an anti-Greta, and it's difficult to avoid the comparison. Close in age, the Swedish Thunberg is 16 and Zeibt is 19. Thunberg warns unceasingly of climate crisis, while Zeibt warns against, quote, climate change alarmism, end quote. Without denying global warming, a trend which she thinks is overestimated, Zeibt questions the impact of human activity on the phenomenon. In the Heartland video, she says that climate change alarmism, quote unquote, at its very core is a despicably anti-human ideology. She also hopes to reassure the young people who mobilized for the Fridays for Future protests initiated by Thunberg, quote, I would like that young people are not made to fear the future or to believe that the older generation are destroying the planet, that the animals are dying out, or that nature is dying, Zeibt had said. While faced with Thunberg's success, Zeit is inspired by its elements of language and communication. She has altered some of the Swedish activist's now famous phrases for her own purposes, transforming, for example, Thunberg's "I want you to panic," quote unquote, from the World Economic Forum in January 2019 to an oppositional "I don't want you to panic, I want you to think," end quote. Well, however, Zeit doesn't like being compared to the author of her source material. Quote, "The reason I don't like the term anti-Greta is that it suggests I'm an indoctrinated puppet myself," she told an interviewer. Well, Zeit claims that unlike Thunberg, she is not being indoctrinated. She places her fight under the virtuous flag of freedom of expression as against so-called groupthink, asserting her right to, quote, "express skepticism based on science," end quote. Now, the German activist says she started being skeptical in 2015, but this had less to do with climate change than with the migrant crisis in Germany. She claimed to be critical of subjects that find consensus in mainstream media, such as immigration, feminism, gender theory, socialism, postmodernism, and climate change, all linked in a sense and open the way to totalitarianism, end quote. German media called Zeit a sympathizer of Germany's far-right Alternative für Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany Party, the third largest political force in parliament. She insists she's not part of AfD or Alternative for Germany. However, her first video, posted on YouTube is a poem on courage written by a competition that Alternative for Germany launched in April of 2019. Zeit also was applauded at an Alternative for Germany meeting in Münster, that's a city, in early February. Now, last November, Zeit participated in a conference of the European Institute for Climate and Energy, the EIKE, or EIKE, a German think tank whose vice president, Michael Limburg, appeared on the Alternative for Germany list for the 2017 legislative elections. It was there that the Heartland Institute, which had hosted conferences with EIKE, first noticed her. But why would an American think tank show so much interest in a teenage German activist? The Heartland Institute received backing from influential Republicans as well as Democrat William Happer, a scientist who served on the White House National Security Council between 2018 and 2019. Happer founded the CO2 Coalition, an organization to defend the vital role of carbon dioxide in our environment, end quote, and is known for having compared the demonization of carbon dioxide to the, quote, demonization of the poor Jews under Hitler, end quote. According to the Washington Post, the Heartland Institute fears that, quote, Germany's strong will to reduce its greenhouse gas emission is contagious. Well, the Post reported that a Heartland director wrote that Zeit was the star of the climate reality forum in Madrid and a person who would be well placed to fight German climate policy. Suspected of being manipulated despite her intentions, Zeit has responded by adopting Thunberg's cri du cœur at a climate action summit in New York City last September. Quote, "How dare you," Zeit asked in a video entitled Message to the Media, and Time magazine named Thunberg its 2019 Person of the Year, and her speech at the United Nations had millions of views on various YouTube channels. Zeit's video thus far has less than 50,000. The comparison between the two activists ends there. And this was an article written by Philippe Thaise. He originally wrote it in French, and it was translated to English. So there you have it. Now, this is very interesting, because who would have expected this at this point? Let me quickly just go back before we continue here. Let's go back to our studio screen. Everything's okay here. And, so let's just see what's going on here. All right, the United Kingdom evidently is threatening to walk away from the European Union trade talks, quote, if no progress is made within 4 months' time. Britain laid out its opening demands for the upcoming trade talks with the European Union on Thursday. It's yesterday, including a blunt threat to walk away from the negotiating table if there is no progress within 4 months. Well, the two sides appear headed for a rocky first round of negotiations as they try to forge a new relationship following the United Kingdom's departure from the now 27-nation bloc. Britain and the European Union both say they want to reach a free trade agreement, but have starkly divergent views on how it should be overseen and what constitutes fair competition between their two economies. The European Union says that Britain must agree to follow the bloc's rules in areas ranging from state aid to environmental protections and to give European boats access to United Kingdom fishing waters if the two sides are to strike a good deal. But the United Kingdom is demanding the right to diverge from the bloc's rules in order to strike new trade agreements around the world that it thinks will bolster the British economy. In pursuit of a deal, we will not trade away our sovereignty, Michael Gove, the minister in charge of Brexit preparations, told lawmakers in the House of Commons. Quote, we will not be seeking to dynamically align with European Union rules on EU terms governed by EU rules and laws and institutions. Well, Britain's negotiating mandate insists that, quote, we will not agree to any obligations for our laws to be aligned with the European Union's or for the European Union's institutions, including the Court of Justice, to have any jurisdiction in the United Kingdom. That conflict will be one of the big hurdles in talks, which are due to begin on Monday in Brussels. Fishing is likely to be another flashpoint. European nations, especially France, want Britain to grant European fishing boats long-term access to UK waters, and Britain wants to negotiate fishing quotas annually. Britain left the European Union on January 31, but remains bound by the bloc's rules until a post-Brexit transition period ends on December 31. A divorce agreement between the two sides allows for the transition to be extended for 2 more years, but British Prime Minister Boris Johnson insists he will not agree to that. Johnson's Conservative government says the United Kingdom will be leaving the bloc's structures, including a single market for trade in goods and services, as of January 1 of 2021. Britain hopes by then to have a trade agreement with a bloc similar to the one struck between the European Union and Canada. Such a deal would eliminate tariffs and quotas on trade in goods, but it's less clear what it would mean for the services sector that makes up 4/5 of Britain's economy. The United Kingdom also aspires to strike side agreements in areas including fisheries, law enforcement, and judicial cooperation. British government is warning businesses that no matter what happens, there will be new barriers to trade between Britain and the European Union, which currently accounts for almost half of UK trade. Even with a free trade deal, there will be new border checks and customs forms to fill out. Now, the European Union-Canada deal also took years to strike. Now the two sides have just months. Well, Britain's negotiating guidelines insist that there is limited but sufficient time to get an agreement. The document says a broad outline, quote unquote, of an agreement should be done by June. It warns if there is not sufficient progress by then, the United Kingdom could walk away and focus on domestic preparations to exit the transition period in an orderly fashion. Now, Britain's tough talk is unlikely to impress European Union negotiators who already accused Johnson of trying to order down commitments Britain made in the divorce deal that paved the way for the country's seamless departure on January 31. That withdrawal agreement dealt with 3 broad issues, citizens' rights after Brexit, Britain's liabilities after 47 years of membership, and the need to keep people and goods flowing freely across the border between European Union member Ireland and Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom. Well, the two sides have agreed to maintain an open border by keeping Northern Ireland aligned to European Union rules, even if the rest of the United Kingdom diverges. But recent comments by Johnson's government seeming to downplay the significance of that agreement have set off alarm bells among European Union leaders. Well, behind the hard rhetoric, the two sides do have room for agreement. Britain has promised it won't undercut the European Union by lowering standards on environmental protection, food hygiene, or workers' rights. But it won't agree to let the European Union be the judge of whether it is living up to those commitments. The challenge for negotiators will be to find a way to make that commitment binding that both sides can agree on. We're not going to engage in some race to the bottom, Johnson said. All we want is mutual recognition of each other's high standards and access to each other's markets. Well, in Brussels, European Union spokesman Dana Spinant said she, quote, wouldn't want to jump to conclusions about the outcome, end quote, of the talks. However, the Commission maintains its capacity to prepare for a no-deal UK exit, even as it prepares for, quote, a positive result of those negotiations, she said. Well, unbelievable, the amount of contention, it's all over the place, just amazing. Now, let's look at what's happening in Greece. Well, Greek islanders have clashed with police over plans to build a new migrant camps. So Greek islanders clashed with police over plans to build a new migrant camp. And so it is absolutely mind-boggling. Let's listen to this report. Bear with me a moment. Get this in a moment. Bear with me. Just want to make sure. Okay, we'll start this up in another second or so.
That their lives are in your hands.
One second.
You have to truly understand that this is not just a job.
1 second. This is amazing. For some reason, this is not functioning. We'll catch it in a moment, hopefully. Okay, 1 second. All right. I don't know why this is not functioning. Bear with me a moment as I try to refresh this page for some reason and see what's gone wrong, if we can. Oh, gosh. All right, let's just see if this works this time. Okay, we should be almost there if it does work.
Just as the coronavirus outbreak appears to be stabilizing in China, each day's news cycle brings stories of new nations and new types of patients impacted. Islam's holiest site, Mecca, shut to pilgrims. Japan, which has ordered all schools closed till the end of spring vacation in early April. They're now wondering whether to stage next summer's Tokyo Olympics. Here in France, as health authorities scrambling to figure out how victims who had no contact with the most infected area came down with COVID-19. 2 months after the detection of the first cases, is it still too early to draw conclusions? How solid is the science? Just how much is the world coming together? As worries grow and stock markets tumble, the French president happens to be in Naples for a long-scheduled summit. With the north of Italy reeling from this continent's worst outbreak, what precautions, what help for a nation whose industrial heartland and tourist trade could be crippled? How much of a test for Europe and for the world? At a time when go-it-alone nationalism is on the rise, can humanity come together with coordinated, credible crisis management and effective collaboration to face what may or may not be an already out-of-control pandemic? Today in the France 24 debate, how to counter a potential pandemic. Joining us, Dr. Jean-Jacques Zembrowski, professor of public health management at Paris's University of Descartes. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
I want to welcome as well. She's been on the front lines of the Ebola outbreak in Congo. Dr. Sashveen Singh is with Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. Thank you for being
here.
Thank you. Matteo Ghisalberti, editor-in-chief of Puch Media.
Good evening, thank you.
Puch Media, which is?
It's an independent media, French-based.
All right, thank you for being with us. Jan Cedric Hansen, Secretary General of the Global Health Security Alliance, joins us from the Normandy capital of Rouen. Thank you for joining us. The France 24 debate on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24debate. Let's start in Geneva, the head of the World Health Organization, coming closer still to labeling it a pandemic. He's still holding back, though, for now.
Our message continues to be that this virus has pandemic potential. Once again, this is not a time for fear. This is a time for taking action now to prevent infections and save lives now.
Dr. Zembrowski, there's a bit of a mixed message there. He's talking about pandemic potential, and then he's saying, don't be afraid. It's not a time for fear.
A potential doesn't mean at all that there is a pandemic going on.
Okay, so define for our viewers what a pandemic is.
It might be, but it might well not be. Nobody knows for the moment. And there is a kind of uncertainty there, whether it will turn into what is called a pandemic or whether it will remain a new type of virus having an ordinary epidemic.
Is it a semantic nuance or an important distinction whether or not it's a pandemic?
Rather like a kind of a nuance. Although the precautions and the size and the number of people involved and the capability of the health authorities and the health power everywhere might not be involved the same way. The more the millions of people suspected of having the virus with them, the more it will be difficult to control that. So it can be a pandemic. The name itself means everybody, while an epidemic is dozens of people, dozens of hundreds of people. Actually, the flu in France is 10,000 people at least who go to the hospital for that reason in France annually, and nobody cares. So it's more than a purely question of vocabulary, a question of level of...
Although, and I'll put it to you, Dr. Jan Cedric Hansen, what we're asking is it out of control already?
No, it doesn't seem to be out of control. It's spreading. It's a natural thing for a virus to spread over a population. And it is using the way that it finds through the population movement and things like that. It would be out of control if our hospitals everywhere would be overcrowded by patients looking for treatment and with large amount of people with lung disease and respiratory distresses. And it is not the case right now. So it is not out of control. And what we need is to have every citizen to be concerned about how to protect himself and the others. And this is the barrier measures. Wash your hands, wear a mask, avoid to be in crowded places. And this would help to stop the spread of that disease.
And also, one of the things that's been talked about is thinking twice before going to the emergency room?
Yes, think twice, because right now the best treatment is the flu treatment and home care. The best treatment if you are touched by that virus is to take aspirin or acetaminophen or very basic drugs that you can have without prescription to decrease the fever and to decrease the sore. So basically, most of the people might even be contaminated or infected without notice, because it seems that most of the cases are actually asymptomatic, which means there's no symptoms, not even fever or maybe some shivering, and that's it. So the part of the mild side of the disease is certainly broader than we can perceive it right now. We are focusing on people with symptoms and the people with the severe, and they are our concern right now, with the respiratory distress. Those are our concern. The others, that's okay.
The others, it's okay?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a few things there that I'll just interject with. So I think, first of all, I agree with some of Dr. Hansen's comments that, that it's not out of control, that it's a natural phenomenon of a virus to be spreading. And certainly that's what we have seen. Of course, it is a concern that there is a new virus that is still being studied and is causing some, significant morbidity in some places. However, it is important to remember, like Dr. Hansen said, that there are a lot of cases that that have minimal symptoms or that have very mild symptoms. In fact, the data suggests that it's about 80% of cases that are reported and diagnosed are mild, and there are probably others that are still milder than that. But I don't agree with the advice to that everyone should wear a mask. There's actually no evidence that wearing a mask in the community is helpful, and I think giving that message is probably just going to spread more fear and panic. Obviously, for healthcare workers that are in contact with patients and in close proximity where there is, you know, coughing and respiratory droplets, then it is useful. But after a lot of systematic reviews, there's no evidence that people just in the community should be wearing a mask.
Dr. Zambrowski, I just wanted to insist on your question about going to the emergency room, because if you are infested with this COVID-19, which is the actual name of this virus, and if you start splitting and shaking the hands of everybody or just being close to those people, then you will have more people infested. So the good thing is in countries like France, for example, we said call an emergency special call center, and they will tell you where to go, whom to see, and how to manage. Because the worst thing, if you do have an infection with this virus, is to go anywhere and spread it all over. So in some countries, you have no other possibility to see a doctor.
Do you agree with Dr. Singh that wearing a mask
in most of the cases, because most of the masks are useless. I mean, it can prevent you from receiving a split from somebody else, but it doesn't. If you are having the virus, it will not prevent the others from catching it from you. And this is probably what happened to those people whom you don't know what was the source of the virus. Those people in the surroundings of Paris, probably, they met someone who, you know, it's the story of a man who met the man who met the man who saw the bear.
Right.
Nobody knows.
We'll talk more about that in a moment. We heard at the outset the head of the WHO saying it's not a time for fear. Fear is certainly something that's contagious. It also sells newspapers. The Daily Mail reporting how the Pope canceled an event in Rome due to what the Vatican calls a slight illness, this one day after he was seen blowing his nose and coughing during Ash Wednesday celebrations. However, it's obviously not that serious, since the spokesman said that Francis would continue with the rest of his day's business. Matteo Ghisalberti, I'll turn to the only other layman on this panel besides me. You know, you go through today oscillating between being reassured and being really worried.
Well, actually, if I consider my country is doing, so Italy, I'm very worried, because Italy unfortunately showed how you don't have to do with a crisis like this, because we saw that the first period when we got the first news from China, the government stopped the flights to and from China. And then when China protested because they considered that these measures was too strong, well, the government said, okay, we don't need to do any quarantine. And if you want, if you feel sick, please stay at home. But it was lead to the volunteer of the people. So everybody was authorized to go everywhere, and when I heard the Prime Minister saying that the hospital in Codogno, which is one of the epicenter of them. Of the pandemic, epidemic, saying that it was their behavior which was wrong, because they contaminated a lot of people. Yes, I said okay, but at the same time, the government says everybody is free to do what he wants, because it's not so big mistake and a big hill to. If you catch this sick.
I think just to step in there. So some of what you say I think is quite valid, that, you know, there was a bit of, you know, potential misinformation, you know, through like media sources, and that differs from what people are told, like from government sources. However, I think we have to stick with what we know with this virus is that, you know, there is potential transmission before people, you know, have significant symptoms. So they might have very mild symptoms or even during an incubation period.
Actually,
so I think it's important to remember that, you know, closing borders and making really restrictive travel restrictions, it's not really going to change practice. I think the virus is out there, and I think what I'm saying is that, I mean, this happens with many different illnesses. It happens with influenza, viruses spread, and be in this strict sort of containment mode, because what we're seeing now is that, you know, these really strict border policies, and it's really affecting it has a lot of flow-on effects, and we in MSF are a little bit concerned that this is going to have quite significant impacts on things like essential surgery. We're new places where we work, like in Yemen and in the DRC, they already struggle. Our Ministry of Health colleagues struggle to deliver, essential surgeries and care, already without a COVID context. And the fact that now, global supply of masks and essential surgical items and drug production could be affected because of these strict importation and border closures, and then the socioeconomic effects that it has on populations and people's livelihoods actually could be quite a lot more significant than...
But let me bring in Jan-Cedric Hansen. You agree that the minuses outweigh the positives when it comes to travel bans?
Oh, yes, definitely. Banning the travel is not a solution. The virus will spread anyway. So the point is we should not consider catching that virus as a magic thing. We should consider that when we catch the virus, it's because there is a load of viral particles in our closed environment that is sufficiently high to trigger the disease inside our body. So when you cross someone for a few seconds in the street, there's no fear. Even if that person shreds some virus particles, it very, very little chance that you catch the disease.
So let me ask you on that point, Dr. Hansen, was Lyon right to host Juventus in the Champions League Wednesday?
Well, as I mentioned on the French side of France 24, it was not wise to have all those people traveling by buses, because during the travel by buses, you increase the chances that some of them get infected. But while they were in watching the match in the place, it's open. There's lots of wind. The virus is diluted. The virus particles are diluted. So it's not that dangerous to be in a crowd where you have lots of air and the air is renewed. So the important there, it's there's no black and white answers or yes or no. It's very subtle. So it's not wise to travel in packed environments, but it's not wise to prevent people from traveling. That's the point, because the virus will go everywhere, no matter. We have to learn to live with that virus and to protect ourselves individually. I just want to make a specific comment to Dr. Singh. When I was mentioning wearing a mask, I was talking about the patients to protect the others.
Absolutely.
And of course,
that's
only the health professionals need to wear the mask and eat different kind of.
Thank you.
That's something very important. Not everybody should wear masks in the streets. That's for sure.
Matteo Ghisalberti, just briefly.
Yes, unfortunately, yes, I agree with the doctors, but I'm not a doctor. The point is that I saw in Italy very, very bad decisions, because yes, that's true that we can't stop, we can close the borders, but we can check the people or we can inform them. For example, we said some minutes ago that it is important not to go to the urgency rooms. Well, in Italy, we went, a lot of people went there because we didn't understand what to do after the changing of the decision of the government. I think that it would be better before to check and say to the people, yes, please do this behavior, have these behaviors. and instead of let them go everywhere and let them decide what to do. I think that in this moment in Italy, we have a lot of self-made solutions to protect themselves.
There isn't a holistic policy, is what you're saying. We're going to pick up on this point when we come back. How far do you go in trying to contain the disease? You're watching the France 24 debate. Welcome back, or welcome if you're just joining us. It's the France 24 debate, and we're sorting fact from fiction when it comes to the coronavirus outbreak, doing so as it on its 50th day seems to be stabilizing in China but spreading elsewhere around the globe, with Dr. Jean-Jacques Zambrowski, who teaches at Paris's Descartes University. Welcome back as well to Dr. Sashvin Singh, with the epidemics team of MSF France, that's Doctors Without Borders. Joining us as well, Matteo Ghisalberti, editor-in-chief of Putsch Media, and from Rouen, France, Jan-Cedric Hansen, who is Secretary General of the Global Health Security Alliance. Yeah, from next Monday till the end of spring break at the start of April, Japan announcing it will be shutting all schools.
There are many efforts being taken to stop the spread of infections among children in various regions. And the next couple of weeks will be an extremely important period.
So shutting schools, Dr. Zambrowski.
Well, we said that in France, in some schools, parents should not bring their children to school if they can, in some of the schools. All this is politics. All this is precautions.
But which is it? Is it precautions or politics?
It's both. It's a political precaution, if I may say so, because there is no scientific evidence, and for the moment there is no children who died from the disease, even in China. But it's uncertain, and until we know, the last people with whom we would like to take any kind of risk are probably children. So, most of the deaths, if not all of them, apart from this 16-year-old man who died in France, were all people with a lot of what we call comorbidities, which is other disease from chest or from the heart or from diabetes and so on. So normally, a sound child or a sound adult has a very little risk, and the symptoms he will have will be those of an ordinary flu. I mean, it's important to remember that all these, like closing the borders and so on, are what I call political precautions. But what would be the reproach to the politicians or the legislators if they would not do that and if anything happened? As we said at the beginning of the conversation, we don't know if it will be a pandemic or nothing but a new kind of virus with an ordinary epidemic.
But you've heard there Matteo Ghisalberti criticizing Italy's government for crisis management that's clumsy, characterizing. So what do you do if you're a neighboring state and you're faced with a country that is sending mixed messages?
We're not going to close the border with Italy.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to close the border with Spain, with Germany, with Belgium, with Luxembourg. We work together. We have a lot of exchanges all day long. And I think the policies over there are reasonable. And now the Italian policy seems to be more reasonable than on the very first hours. They probably were wrong in the very first hospital. They probably did not warn enough, took enough precautions. But nowadays they do. And the meeting the European ministers had together is precisely there to set a common EU policy. I don't know. I'm not meaning that in Middle East or in Africa, where the risk exists as well as here, or even in Japan, which is not that far from the core of the infection, the same policies would be any valid. Probably not.
Matteo Ghisalberti, of course, we've heard the far-right leader in Italy, Matteo Salvini, like the far-right leader here in France, talking about closing borders.
Yes, actually, the point is that there was a mix on political and precaution topics in Italy. And when Mr. Salvini said, please take care of the situation and decide some quarantine, well, the government said something very political. No, you are racist. No, we can't do this measures because take these measures because it's a way to be racist against Asian people or Chinese people, especially the communities who are living in near Florence, which are very, very big. But to the point, it was not political. It was just a measure to save people and to make in safety people. So I think that the problem is that the Italian government mixed with political problems, they are political problems, with
same in France. The right party, the Marine Le Pen's party, closed the borders, took the precautions. It's the principle of precaution, which has no medical sense. I mean, they can go in the politics where they want. I mean, okay. It's up to them, their opinion. But it has no scientific evidence at all.
All right. As you said earlier, it's early days yet for the data, Sash been saying. According to statistics I saw from the Reuters news agency, they think it's 3.4%
less
cases that are lethal.
Far less.
Yeah,
perhaps less. We're not sure.
Yeah.
You've been working in Congo with Ebola, where the mortality rate is much higher. How does containment work when you have an outbreak like this?
I guess it's a good point that you brought up about the you know, we kind of have to keep things a little bit in context as well. So I mean, the Democratic Republic of Congo is in the like still in the midst of an Ebola epidemic, and also in I think it's really important to mention that they're also in the biggest epidemic ever of measles, with you know, significant morbidity, particularly in malnourished children, and so it's a huge epidemic. In places where we work, where you know, we do have a lot of experience in being able to like ramp up quickly in infection control measures. So, for example, from an MSF perspective, what we've been doing with our field teams is really encouraging going back to basics with the infection prevention and control procedures that we've already discussed, about good hand washing, good cleaning of hospitals, and really things that should be done that they're not specific to coronavirus. We also put in place...
Does that make a difference?
Yes, of course it does, yeah. So I think what we find actually is during, and this happened during like SARS, and it happens during big influenza outbreaks, but, you know, all over the world, you encourage good IP, like what we call IPC, infection prevention and control measures, and then we sort of see a reduction in other illnesses like gastrointestinal illnesses, because people are paying really good attention to simple things like hand washing. But, yeah, we do, we've provided some preparedness planning to our field. We've, like, and ask our field teams to approach the local ministries of health to offer some support and some simple training, so to really help I won't use the word containment, because as we've discussed, then you know, these viruses do spread quickly, and we might not necessarily be able to contain them, but really to prevent illness, prevent the spread, particularly to sick people that are presenting to hospitals with other infections.
The closest disease in terms of symptoms is flu, ordinary flu, with a virus we've known for years. The mortality of the flu infection in our countries is 1 out of 1,000. The mortality of the COVID-19, the coronavirus, seems to be 1 out of 100, not 3.5. We are reducing the figures now to 1,
so
it's 10 times
better.
More. 10 times more. Now, yet... the measures and the symptoms are just the same, and the people who died from the same kind of severe respiratory syndromes and so this malfunction. No, the question is, how do we control those people who have something that looks like a flu clinically and that have been infested, and how were they infested? And to scale up to what we call the zero case, or the case zero, which is the origin, the source of the virus, from the market in Wuhan, in China, to them, including in Italy. And the
gentle reproach we can have to the people in this hospital in Italy where the patients came from China is, why didn't they just ring the bell when they admitted this patient coming back from this group of patients coming back from China and said they have a probability or a possibility and done the test? The test is available now everywhere in all of our countries. Mm. Again, I'm afraid I cannot discuss it of the capability of Yemen you mentioned,
And what about, and I'll put this to Dr. Jan Cedric Hansen. What about all the talk of searching for a vaccine, because we don't have one yet? Does it, at this point in time, when you listen to Jean-Jacques Zambrowski, is it urgent, or is that not the biggest priority at this point?
Well, it's always interesting to work on different solutions, but right now, as you mentioned, the vaccine might come late. The natural history of epidemics is, to one point, it slows down, and maybe by the time the vaccine would come, the actual outbreak would dampen. But it would be interesting to have it for a next outbreak. So it's important to work on that. What is more important is to work on the symptomatic treatment, because that is what is the most important right now. How to control the lung disease and how to control, because that coronavirus has a specific tropism, what means it likes to infect the heart of the people. And because it weakens your lungs and your heart, it kills you when it comes to frailty people, elderly. But if we can use against that virus, we may and we should try the antivirals that are already available, because we've made tremendous progress in killing or treating viral disease. And there is lots of armamentarium regarding this now with antiviral drugs. So maybe among them, there might be some good candidates as well.
Yeah, authorities in China are expressing hope in the use of, and you mentioned it, chloroquine, the anti-malarial treatment. Agreed, says French virologist Didier Raoult. His team at Marseille's Mediterranean Institute of Infectious Diseases has been touting the virtues of chloroquine for 10 years, he says.
There's a kind of excitement, a need to find new medicines. We have to find new vaccines. If you tell them, look, you can just take chloroquine, it's easy, it's not expensive, you don't want to take it, you're cutting the ground from under the feet from a whole host of people who think they're going to win the Nobel Medicine Prize for a new medicine or a new vaccine against coronavirus. When you look at the number of new vaccines that have been marketed the past 30 years, the chances of making a new vaccine that can be marketed is close to zero.
So here's the question, Sashvin Singh. Right now, the scramble for a treatment, either a vaccine or palliative care for some kind of treatment for the disease. Is there this callous race to win prizes and make a lot of money going on?
I think that's a bit of a cynical view, and but no, I think there are some really interesting things that came out of the West African epidemic of Ebola, for example. So and also from SARS. So you know, having these big sudden epidemics that do cause, you know, a lot of distress, also kind of brings in a lot of investment into health care and health sciences. And so what we do see is a rapid sort of progression of technologies investment in researchers. So what I just wanted to say with the coronavirus is that there was already a mechanism in place where you know, there's a group that's been around since 2017 to respond to new and emerging diseases.
And when you hear Dr. Raoult say, why are we looking for all this stuff when we've got chloroquine?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't think we've got good evidence that that works. There are some encouraging results on a few tests, and there are some clinical trials, more than a dozen clinical trials on the go in China at the moment, looking at several different antiviral medications that could be promising. I think the research into like therapeutics and vaccines is really important, but I want to come back to the basics of preparedness and thinking about the bigger picture.
Thinking about the bigger picture, Jan Cedric Hansen.
Yeah, well, the back to the chloroquine story. It's a very old product, a very interesting treatment, and it has anti-inflammatory and fever killer properties. So there is lots of confusion in the use of that product. Maybe it's just a side effect that it actually dampens the disease rather than cure the disease. So we should be very cautious, and the publications available are not exactly scientific articles. They are more, I do believe that, I have noticed that, but this is, we should be cautious on that claim about the chloroquine. What Dr. Singh just said, working on different kind of solution and options and see what works the best is more relevant. And again, prevention is more, it's more interesting to invest in prevention and mitigation of the disease rather than to cure it. Because as Dr. Zambrowski said, it's just like a flu. Even of the severe cases are more likely to die. The mild cases are just like a flu.
All right, before we go, because we're running short on time, we must talk about how it's spooking citizens and markets. The stock exchanges continue to tumble. Wall Street down 9% this week. The Paris Exchange is into what investors call correction territory, more than 10%. Proof of how interconnected the world is. At the epicenter of the outbreak in Italy, the Lombardy town of Codogno, which is under lockdown, it's home to an electronics manufacturer that supplies Fiat, Renault, and German car makers. 60 of the factory's 600 employees have been allowed back in thanks to a special dispensation. They'll be staying under quarantine while working to keep the plan running. Otherwise, it's assembly lines across the continent that might shut, they say. The French finance minister, he says the coronavirus is forcing a complete rethink of supply chains and how our economies run.
I really think that we have to take the situation of the epidemic to ask ourselves about our strategic dependence in terms of supply for certain industrial sectors. I've talked about the car industry. I also want to talk about the health industry. You know that 80% of raw materials for active components, for medicines, come from China or from Asia. It's obvious, and the epidemic shows it, that this could bring about problems on sanitary independence in the medium or long term. We have to respond to this challenge and this risk.
So, is that a valid point we're hearing from Bruno Le Maire, or is this political flag-waving, saying we got to make in Europe or make in France rather than in Asia or China?
Well, actually, I think that the situation with Italy is different from the economical relations among China and France, because Italy, first of all, is close to France, and then we have a lot of industries which are strictly connected, not only financial one, because many Italian banks are controlled by French one, and so if the activities stop, French activity could have could tumble, and
that's why markets are dropping right now.
But there are a lot of fields which are interconnected. For example, if you consider foods, for example, luxury, but also furnitures, which are produced in Italy and sold in France. Well, there's a lot of things that could be affected in the next week. So what do you think? The finance minister is saying we have to have shorter supply chains for everything, not just cars.
Yeah, actually, I think that, in some fields, it will be harder to find a new way to produce and to have another logistic system. I think that, cars could affect hardly the economy.
Jean-Jacques Zambrowski?
You know, the world has shrunk in the recent decades. And so, for example, all of a car can be manufactured in Germany or in Italy or in the UK, but a bolt, a screw, might be coming from China. And so, you know the story, for want of a nail, etc. And the kingdom was lost, all that for a horseshoe nail. That's a bit of an English poetry. But it's exactly the same. For want of a screw, you can be missing how to terminate a car or a piece of factory or an electronic device or even a camera in a TV channel. So we are depending from one from the others. It's true that the total dependence we have towards China in the recent years might be a problem, which this epidemic or whatever it is revealing. So having some kind of manner to have a supply chain which will not be totally depending on the boats sailing out of China might be worth. But you cannot improvise. It's just making a vaccine. It will take months, if not years, to repatriate, to come back to Europe, some things like antibiotics, the components of which are all made in China or sometimes in India. So it's a real issue. We might dialogue with the Chinese people and see what we can do. Because the European factories, car manufacturers in China, had to close and reopen, as your correspondent just said. But the other way around is true as well. Some components in the purely French-made car or Italian cars come from China. And we might, if that would be long, there might be some risk for the economy. It's said that the rate of the economy, the GDP, might decrease by 0.1% in the next year due to this crisis if it ends in the next 2 or 3 months.
We'll see what happens afterwards. Just very briefly, because Jan Cedric Hansen, we're almost out of time.
Yes, sir. Oh, sorry. Okay. Too bad.
No, I was just gonna.
Can I say?
Just very quickly, go ahead.
I wanted to say that, yeah. The Global Health Security Alliance was created just because the point is that health can impact any aspects of the society, and there is an interdependency between health, economic, politics, and we try to analyze and figure out the nexus of all those components of the society. Through the health standpoint, because the health standpoint can sometimes, and we are facing that, impact the complete society. And here it's a global society we're talking to. Mm-hmm.
And the converse is true as well. So like the socioeconomic economic factors have a huge impact on health, and it's really important to remember that when coming up with these ideas of closing borders, and it's really going to be affecting health and have secondary effects.
Sreen Singh, I want to thank you so much. I want to thank as well Jean-Jacques Zambrowski, Matteo Ghisalberti, Jan Cedric Hansen for being with us from Rouen. Stay with us. Media Watch is next. And we say hello to James Creedon.
Hi, Francois. Look at the French media coverage of the ongoing coronavirus epidemic. Although it's made the front pages again today. Le Parisien, France, it's now France's turn to feel the pressure. And of course, there was that first fatality. And indeed, Emmanuel Macron saying today that really we're looking towards an epidemic. We also saw the carnivals in Nice and other festivities in Menton cancelled, of course, down near the Italian border, a particular concern in the south of France that contamination is more likely. Headlines such as this as well, talking about the coronavirus being China's globalization Chernobyl. In other words, an event almost as big in terms of the impact or the knock-on effect or the domino effect as Chernobyl was for the USSR. Certainly, as strong
language.
Really
knew that
3 years
later with hindsight that,
right,
that it was going to bring down the Soviet Union.
Exactly. There you go. So that's the sort of language being used in headlines and in editorial pieces. This is in L'Opinion, also in the French press. Here they're being a little bit ironic about what they call the repli sur soi, kind of what would you say, folding, looking inward, or regressive thinking, if you like. So they talk about the homo coronavirus. You kind of, it's a reference to a basic man. And they're saying a mammal marked by its inward looking and tribalist nature, And Remy Godot goes on to write that everywhere nationalists are rubbing their hands with glee, and unless the government wants to add fuel to the fire of far-right anti-immigrant rhetoric, they would have an interest in not allowing their talking points to be contaminated by catastrophist discourse. Quite colourful language there, but I think that the warning that this could be a gift really to far-right thinking and closing of borders and whatnot, a measured and responsible approach is the best one against the epidemic, says that piece. They're even imagining here what would happen if Emmanuel Macron got infected by the virus. Now, that seems completely crazy, except we know that the deputy health minister of Iran was coughing and spluttering on air because he did get it himself, so it's not a completely impossible scenario. But they sort of, you know, things are getting quite Romanesque, if you like, and this Robin Tutange was looking at the health history of various French presidents in the past and those who were hospitalised and what would happen. And, of course, Emmanuel Macron would have to be quarantined like everyone else, but he would be able to probably continue with his job to some extent. Anyway, we saw that he
he's not in the age risk category.
No, that was also mentioned, that 42, his health, he'd be likely to be fine. Okay. Most of the deaths have been older people, I guess. In any case, we saw that he did speak to hospital staff today at Pitié-Salpêtrière, and of course he did get a lot of criticism because they've been taking kind of industrial action in recent weeks and months. So this was an opportunity to tell them exactly what they think the health system needs to fight pandemics or whatever else. Now, there's a lot more to be said on the way in which the coronavirus is impacting on the political sphere. It's become a political football in the US and elsewhere. Even Democrats are being accused of distorting the US, the readiness of the US for the coronavirus. You're seeing lots of comments such as this. And weeks ago, we were all going to die from World War III because Trump killed Soleimani. But now we're all going to die from the coronavirus. The left is becoming a doomsday cult. So even if there is a degree of disinformation or exaggeration, then it's being taken on board as conspiracy theory fodder, I think you could say. Anyway, there's lots more on that. But criticism as well from Donald Trump's appointment of Mike Pence as the coronavirus czar, given I'll just read it out. Pence doesn't believe in science, fueled the worst AIDS outbreak in Indiana's history while governor, et cetera, et cetera. I'll just finish very quickly with the falling sales of Corona beer. This is a real thing.
Oh, really?
Yes, Corona beer. These are
not the antidote.
No, and unfortunately, from their marketing point of view, it is going down. Some people saying as well that this Mexican beer, from the U.S. perspective, that perhaps a border wall needs to be built in order to keep illegal Mexican beer out. Stick to real American beer. So a touch of humor, but also I suppose referring to the fact that some people would like to see borders go back up in the midst of all this.
All right, we'll discuss the relative virtues of Bud Light and Corona another time. Many thanks, James Sweet, and I want to thank our panel once again. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 today.
Okay, let's just see what else is happening here. Oh, my goodness. Well, very, very compelling sort of stuff that's happening all over the world. Let me just quickly look and see. We just found out this. The World Health Organization is upgrading the global risk of the coronavirus spread to, quote, very high, end quote. This just came out. So see where that goes. It looks like Business Daily claims that $3 trillion has been wiped off global markets over the coronavirus fears. The stock market turmoil continues over the coronavirus fears. Tourism is down because of the coronavirus outbreak. And there's a global sell-off of stock all over the world because of the coronavirus, crisis. And that's how it looks. And even the airline industry is bracing for losses as the coronavirus fears continue. So a tremendous amount of stuff is happening around the world because of this interconnectedness. And even though people think that they need to bring capacity internally to a nation, Can America take care of its own in every sector? Can France do it? Can Germany do it? Can Russia do it? Can Brazil do it? Who can afford to do that? Can China do it on its own? Who knows? And then with so much of the material that's available only from one place in the world, or two or three or four or five, it's not enough to evidently make it all function. So there's just so much that's interconnected that it cannot function without one aspect of an ingredient or a technology, technological capacity in another place, and so on and so forth. It is unbelievable how far we've come, and yet at the same time, as we've evolved from something that was locally, managed or locally developed and technologically advanced on the local level, is now strewn all over the world. So you may get like a screw from one place and a spring from another, and the battery from a third place, and some sort of combustion capacity from another place, and it goes on and on and on. It's unending, and everything is interconnected, even though it may say made in America, it's possibly made in America, but from ingredients from all over the world. And in other places of the world, it may be made in China, but also probably to lesser degree from products that are imported into China. But even so, no matter how you look at it, trade is the underpinning of every society. And then you've got the political direction and directives of government that are as part of the politics that moved it forward on those fronts. And it's all literally interconnected. So those are the major, major concerns, and those are the issues of the day. Well, let me just quickly check to see if there's anything else that we need to cover with you, or that we should cover with you. As I approach the conclusion, I just want to make sure that we've done as much as possible here. Well, this was interesting because there's a pilgrimage that's going on in Saudi Arabia, and pilgrims in Saudi Arabia are defying the coronavirus risks. It seems that cleaners scrub and sterilize the floors of Mecca's Grand Mosque after fears of coronavirus led Saudi Arabia to suspend pilgrim visas, but worshippers appear unfazed, confident of God's protection. Saudi Arabia is home to Islam's holiest sites, and on yesterday, they suspended entry by foreigners for the year-round Umrah pilgrimage, an unprecedented move that has left tens of thousands in limbo. It has also sparked uncertainty over the annual Hajj pilgrimage scheduled for July. But Nadia Bitam, a 50-year-old Algerian donning a veil to perform Umrah for the first time, counted herself fortunate as she arrived in Mecca 5 days before Riyadh's abrupt decision. "I have no fear," she said. "We are in the hands of God," said Bitam, who's 50, wearing a face mask and accompanied by her sister Fatima. "What matters for us is worship, but we are taking precautions." Saudi Arabia has so far reported no coronavirus cases, but there are mounting concerns over a spike in infections across the Middle East. The Grand Mosque was packed with worshippers like Bitam on Friday, underscoring how faith often trumps health concerns and the challenge of disease control. Floors of the Grand Mosque are washed 4 times a day, and 13,500 carpets in areas designated for prayer are regularly cleaned, according to the official Saudi press agency, SPA. Grand Mosque officials Yaber Wadani said that the best cleaning and sterilization methods were in use, with all carpets scrubbed and perfumed daily. Agence France-Presse saw cleaning crews wearing green face masks, sterilizing floors with disinfectants, including chlorine. and face masks are useful in guarding against infection, said Robina Mahmoud, leading a group of 105 pilgrims from the Netherlands. Her group was also taking precautions, such as regularly washing their hands. This will definitely protect us, but the rest is in God's hands, she said. Inside the mosque, the area surrounding the Kaaba, a cube structure that is the focal point of Islam, was packed with tens of thousands of worshippers, most of them wearing masks. Muslims around the world pray in the direction of the Kaaba, which is draped in a gold-embroidered black cloth. Three pharmacies around the Grand Mosque said they had run out of masks. The demand for masks in the last 2 days is unprecedented, a Syrian doctor told Agence France-Presse. I've sold 200 boxes in 3 days, which used to be our monthly stock. But other traders reported losses following the decision to suspend Umrah visas. Whole groups of pilgrims have canceled their hotel reservations, said Mahfouz, an Egyptian who works as an independent travel agent. I'm still counting my losses, he said. The pilgrimage forms a crucial source of revenue for the government, which hopes to welcome 30 million religious visitors annually to the kingdom by 2030. Alongside Thursday's pilgrimage curb, it has also temporarily suspended electronic tourist visas for people arriving from 7 countries, including China, Italy, Japan, South Korea, and Kazakhstan, according to the SBA. So it added that tourist visa holders will not be allowed to visit Mecca and Medina, another holy city. Authorities inside this insist the suspensions are temporary, but it was unclear when they will be lifted. And we receive hundreds of thousands of pilgrims every month from different countries around the world, the Saudi official told Agence France-Presse. If coronavirus arrives here and spreads, it will be a global epidemic. The safety of people is more important than performing Umrah. But many pilgrims appeared defiant. How can we be afraid if we are in the house of God, said 21-year-old Turkish student Hossam Aldin. Even if I got the infection, it would be good to die as a martyr here. And you hear that from so many people, particularly religious people, who believe in the protection of God. And I would also agree that God's influence is there, but we may all pray to different definition of who God may be, but that becomes a real issue. Well, let me just quickly point out that in Nigeria on Friday, today, they announced the first confirmed case of the novel coronavirus in sub-Saharan Africa. The case is an Italian citizen who works in Nigeria and returned from Milan, Italy to Lagos, Nigeria on the 25th of February. Health Minister Osagie Ehanire said in a statement on Twitter. So, prior to the case in Nigeria, just 2 cases had surfaced across all of Africa, in Egypt and in Algeria, a tally that had puzzled health specialists, given the continent's close economic ties with China. The World Health Organization warned earlier this week that African health systems were ill-equipped to respond to the deadly coronavirus outbreak should cases start to proliferate on the continent. Yep, so that's the story. Well, I see we've come to the end of our time with you today, and what we'll do is we'll simply wish you a good day, and thank you for being with us, and we'll hope to speak to you on Monday of next week. Have a great weekend. All the best, and thank you for being with us. Goodbye.